Thanks very much indeed, Ian. Hello. The musicians of the BBC Philharmonic join us tonight with a programme ranging across three centuries, from Mozart and Mahler to Oliver Nussen. This music, a real test of these players' skill and energy across a variety of musical styles. And tonight's conductor certainly knows these players well. He spent 10 years in their company as chief conductor. He's now their conductor laureate. He is Gian Andrea Nozeda, and I spoke to him earlier about the three very different pieces on offer in tonight's prom.
I've been wondering for several days if there is any connecting line for these three composers, and by the end of the rehearsals I found out all the three pieces are connected with ghostly, spiritic, in a way, atmospheres. For instance, the Don Giovanni is always connected with the late coming of the statue of the Commandor. In the Second Symphony of Knassen, the second movement is shadowy or just ghostly, because the text he's making a music for is called Die Ratz. And Mahler 7 is a very mysterious symphony. Of course, it's considered the most joyful, but honestly, it is a very strange happiness from the Italian point of view. So it's a very demanding program, but I think this is the common element, just linking all the three pieces.
Gian Andrea Nozeda talking to me earlier today. Well, tonight's leader, Yuri Torchinsky, in place with the players of the BBC Philharmonic, who stand now to welcome tonight's conductor, their conductor laureate, Gian Andrea Nozeda, opening tonight's prom with the overture to Mozart's opera, Don Giovanni. The BBC Philharmonic and conductor Gianandrea Nozeda opening the second of four proms they're giving this season here at the Royal Albert Hall. The overture to Mozart's Don Giovanni. Well, next this evening, we're in the musical company of Oliver Nussen. The composer turned 60 this year, and he's been described in many quarters as the most important figure in modern British music. Well, Nussen was a precocious talent, publishing his first works in his early teens. He wrote his first symphony when he was a mere 15, but he later withdrew that piece. So tonight we're going to hear what is, in effect, Nussen's first orchestral work, his second symphony. It was completed in 1971, by which time the composer had reached the grand old age of 90. It's a symphony come song cycle. It features a solo soprano singing texts by the poets Georg Trakl and Sylvia Plath. Earlier, we caught up with tonight's soloist, Gillian Keith, and asked her about how Nussen creates the extraordinary dark atmospheres of this symphony through the words of those two writers.
Both poets were troubled souls, suffered from depression, and this comes through, especially in the Trakl and Die Ratten. You get this image of the rats scurrying around, and they scurry through the strings, and then they stop, and the woodwinds hold the cord, and you can feel their beady eyes looking out of the darkness, and it's empty, broken window, shattered glass, dust. They're crawling in and out of the latrine. You can just smell the stink of them coming out of the back dark corners of the garden shed, if you will. And then he takes us into another amazing poem, Sylvia Plath's Edge, which was perhaps her very last poem, and there's a very eerie quality to it. It's very floated. And then the final Trakl poem that we get in its entirety, An die Schwester, has again a shadowy feel, but there's something a bit more triumphant, a bit more grounded. So there is a lot of uncertainty with rhythms and the way the text comes across. So it's my job to bring those feelings that came from the poets, these troubled ideas, right off the page.
Tonight's soprano Gillian Keith there talking to us earlier. It's not the first time that she's worked with tonight's conductor, Gianandrea Nozeda. They've done songs by Dalla Piccola together. And she's a singer of great range and incredible pitch, Gillian Keith. I was sitting in on rehearsals earlier today. The most fearsomely challenging vocal line in this Nussen symphony. It's completely untethered to what's going on in the orchestra. It soars around all over the place. You just need perfect pitch to deliver it. And Gillian Keith said, you almost really need to learn this music from memory. There is no time to read the notes, you just need to know them. Well, certainly if anybody's going to pull off this piece, it'll be her. She's got a great range and repertoire, this singer. Not the first time she's sung at proms. She was here in 2004, singing the Jew Fairy in Humperdinck's Hansel and Gretel. And here she is now, tonight's soprano, Canadian singer Gillian Keith, with conductor Gianandrea Nozeda and members of the BBC Philharmonic, here to perform at the proms Oliver Nussen's Second Symphony.
Thank you. blacks crackle and drag.
Music full of astonishing confidence and originality, a piece that shows that even at the age of 19, Oliver Nussen had that rare ability to really evoke mood and atmosphere. That was his second symphony performed here at the Proms by the BBC Philharmonic, conducted by Jan Andrea Nozeda, the leader tonight, Yuri Torchinsky. Gillian Keith, the soloist, And Canadian soprano is a real favourite here in London of both English National Opera and the Royal Opera House. She's sung music there by Strauss, Britten, Verdi, Monteverdi, Purcell, Bach, huge range of repertoire. And singing that really challenging music by Oliver Nussing here at the Proms tonight. Well, as we said earlier, a big year for Oliver Nussing. He turns 60 in June. Celebrations with Birmingham Contemporary Music Group at this year's Opera Festival. They had a double bill of opera performances there last month. The LA Philharmonic doing its bit with the Nussing mini season in October. And his two operas, Higgledy Piggledy Pop and Where the Wild Things Are, will be coming to London in November. That's part of the BBC's Total Immersion Festival. Well, that is it for part one. In the second part of tonight's program, we're going to be hearing one of Gustav Mahler's darkest works, his Seventh Symphony, full of the sounds of the night, but with an extraordinary triumphal end to the piece. Meanwhile, though, don't go anywhere right now. It's interval time, and we have a Proms Plus event for you. It was recorded over the road at the Royal College of Music, and it's the latest in our line of interviews featuring musicians talking about their literary passions. The event was introduced by Anne McElvoy.
Tonight we're going to be talking to the conductor David Hill, one of Britain's leading choral conductors and an organist himself. David conducts the BBC Singers and is musical director of the Bach Choir, and perhaps, like me, some of you have his extraordinarily haunting recording of Tallis' Spem in Alium Motet in your CD collection. He's a conductor who can make 16th century music cross the centuries and offer up its full beauty and inventiveness to modern audiences, while also being an accomplished conductor of 20th century works, particularly Benjamin Britten. And fittingly, David, you have an eclectic range of literary favourites to discuss with us today, spanning the centuries and forms. So I rather wondered, do you look for escape in your reading, or do you want to complement what you're working on musically?
A bit of both. In a sense, the music is important to me in terms of just reading around it, and so it takes a lot of time in the preparation of things. So it's spare time, really, the odd, you know, time when you're on a train or indeed on a holiday, when it's great to be able to pick up a book and have a really good read. So I really enjoyed doing this, but it made me really read for this event, but actually realising you find quality time to do it.
Absolutely. The purpose of these events makes us all think we must find more time to do it. Choral music is quite close to poetry in the sense that you've got poetic language built into both. Is that a particular attraction for you?
Yes. I mean, choral music doesn't mean anything unless it's to la la la. If some of it is. But, you know, you've got words which actually were the very reason why that composer was setting those words into the music they wished to create from the words. So in fact, I think this flow is so important to me as a musician who works, I mean, obviously with choral singers and orchestras, but particularly with the singers, you can actually talk to them about what you think the author may have meant. And it's very, you know, this is permeates our lives.
Well, let's have your first reading. You've chosen an extract from Vikram Seth's An Equal Music, a popular choice of classical musicians. But could you just introduce this extract briefly for us, and then David Bamber is going to read it.
Well, this is essentially a love story between two musicians, a violinist and a pianist, who worked and met each other in Vienna as students. And very suddenly, the relationship was stopped because he fell out with his violin teacher in Vienna, as one does with teachers from time to time. And she was completely heartbroken because he hadn't told her he was going to leave. And suddenly, in Oxford Street, not very far away from here, he sees her 10 years later on another bus, and from that point onwards really tries to pursue her and rekindle a relationship. And it starts with Radio 3.
Perfect. David Bamber, over to you.
I put down the phone and lie in bed with my hands behind my head. I have not heard from Julia for 3 days. I get up and pad around the flat, putting up the blinds. I turn on Radio 3. For me, Even with a rack full of CDs to choose from and in a city as rich in concerts as London, this is, morning or evening, an almost instinctive reaction. Now it often brings me pleasure and surprise. But when I lived in Rochdale, it was my lifeline, virtually my only source of classical music. Once a year, the Halle Orchestra performed in Champness Hall. Three or four times a year, Mrs. Formby would take me to a recital organised by the local music society or something special in Manchester. But that was the sum of my contact with professionally performed live music. My small radio, which plucked music from the public air, was everything to me. I would listen to it for hours in my room. As with the public library in Manchester, I don't see how I could have become a musician without it. In the lessening darkness, I look for Venus. Dawn is breaking. A horizontal upwelling of pink, with one almost vertical gash of a contrail, like Lucifer hurtling down the sky. I turn the kettle on and empty a vase full of thick twigs of holly, the berries by now almost black, into the rubbish. A Bach cantata is being performed, Wie schön leuchtet der Morgenstern. The words put me in mind of one of Julia's favourite comic poets. It is a tangled web that I am weaving. If I have survived 10 years of absence and vacant regret, why are 3 days so unbearable?
The novel is about a long relationship between two musicians with its twists and turns. Why do you feel connected to it? Is it the music or is it the love affairs?
Oh, both. I think the love affair is very real. It's obviously very passionate. They were young, but there was something very special there. And you can hear from that extract a real note of regret in his voice. That sense in which he's a depressed man. You know, he's seen a person he really loves, yet he can't have her. And that's 10 years past. She's married, actually. She's got a son now. And things have moved on in some respects, but he's trying to turn the clocks back. And I think that may be a moral in this, that, you know, seize it while you can, probably. But there we are. This is how he builds the story. Also around the very difficult relationships, if you like, that exist between musicians sometimes. I would call it a healthy tension and release, which is also part of what good music making is about. And the tension and release is really between the members of the Maggiore string quartet, of which he is second violinist. And you sense that through their rehearsals and through their performing, you get this sense of the difficulty of trying to relate to each other. So it's a fantastic piece of writing by Seyth, who understands, I think, very, very clearly what pressures musicians are under in their pursuit of art and making great music. What happens in the relationship becomes even more complex in a way, because he introduces another aspect to it, which is more tragic, is that she's going profoundly deaf whilst having to somehow exist with her music. And these things, you know, to a musician, but going deaf is the worst possible thing, and we know from Beethoven's time, yes, how much that was difficult to deal with. So that was an added and really very difficult aspect of the whole relationship.
The main character was trained in Manchester, and at a lot of places in the book that you used to haunt as a student at Chet's, the music college there yourself.
Indeed, absolutely, yes. I mean, he's from Rochdale. Not that I know Rochdale that well, but certainly he talks about the Henry Watson Music Library in Manchester and other places, and the cathedral in Manchester. Yes, the haunts that I used to know about when I was at school at Cheetham's all those years ago. So, yes.
And we won't ask you about your love affairs at Chet's.
The love affairs at Chet's, well, they did exist. Yes, they did exist, but in a slightly different way to this.
This time, Wordsworth and a poem that some of you may be familiar with, Daffodils, but also with a geographical location.
Yes, why daffodils? I mean, everyone knows it. Well, it's because I'm from, I could call it Cumberland. I've always objected to Cumbria, to Cumberland, and was brought up in the north of Carlisle, and I was very lucky. I had a wonderful childhood. Went to a great primary school where the headmaster had three passions. He said, now look, you have to understand, you've got to know about the Lake District, you've got to understand about Hadrian's Wall, and you must understand about William Wordsworth. Now, couple that with the fact that my grandparents were farming just a few miles away from indeed where Wordsworth wrote so much of his poetry, just on the edge of the Lake District. And we did genuinely, every other week, run around the fields and through the woods in the farm, and we saw these daffodils and we actually realised what he was writing about. So yes, very special memories for me.
I wandered lonely as a cloud that floats on high o'er vales and hills, when all at once I saw a crowd, a host of golden daffodils. Beside the lake, beneath the trees, fluttering and dancing in the breeze. Continuous as the stars that shine and twinkle on the Milky Way, they stretched in never-ending line along the margin of a bay. 10,000 saw I at a glance, tossing their heads in sprightly dance. The waves beside them danced, but they outdid the sparkling waves in glee. A poet could not but be gay in such a jocund company. I gazed and gazed, but little thought what wealth the show to me had brought. For oft, when on my couch I lie, in vacant or in pensive mood, they flash upon the inward eye, which is the bliss of solitude. And then my heart with pleasure fills and dances with the daffodils.
David Hill, when you on your couch do lie in vacant or in pensive mood, if this ever happens to a musician as busy as you, when you reflect on that poem, it takes you back, as you said, to your childhood, but now you're listening to it as a mature adult.
Yes, and always with a sense of feeling that one day I'd like to get back to the north and to Cumbria and Cumberland, as I would like to call it. But in a way, knowing that it was part of a childhood and something that really was very special. I think it was particularly the farm and being there so much and running around those areas, as I said, where you really felt a freedom. And in those days, you know, we did have freedom. It was wonderful to be able to do that and just explore in our own way. And then my brother became a curate in Cockermouth, which is just around the corner from where Wordsworth was, and in one stage he lived. And so that was a sense in which, you know, we really did share so much about what the man was.
He was the local lad made good.
Well, indeed.
And another one here. I mean, just tell me a bit about how you then moved from that background, which, as you say, is farming, but you clearly from early on had an interest in words and a poetic sense. And what took you towards music?
Partly, I think, my grandmother at the farm, she was a wonderful singer and a pianist, and she led all of us into music if we wanted to do that. And my elder brother, who has been a great influence on me, and music was around. And I suppose being a choir boy in a church choir, we had the shockingly bad choir that I sang in, but we did sing and we did have a go at it, and I think all those things have a big impression on you. You know, singing words, sometimes you stop to think about them and what they might mean. Yes. And so yes, these are things that as you grow older you respect much more.
For now, let's have another reading. This is from John Irving's novel A Prayer for Owen Meany. Two time frames in this book and reflections on childhood and adulthood, but also strong religious themes, which I presume appeal to you as a conductor of religious music.
Well, indeed, and the character, Owen Meany, it's a central character of the book, where the bit we're about to hear is, in fact, at warfare with the new headmaster of the school. And Owen Meany is an incredibly charismatic and persuasive sort of character, and he's managed to persuade the football team to lift the Volkswagen Beetle belonging to a teacher in the school and to put it into the school main hall on the stage. And by the time we get to this hilarious extract, the headmaster and staff are already engaged in a futile attempt to remove the beetle from the stage. It's hilarious.
David Bamber is going to read us an extract from A Prayer for Omini by John Irving.
Who can really piece together all the details of such a case? I mean, who can ever get straight what happened exactly? It was an emotional moment for the headmaster, and there was no overestimating the pain in his lower back. He had lifted the car all by himself. Whether his back muscles went into spasms while he was attempting to steer the VW downstairs, or whether he suffered the spasms after his spectacular accident, well, this is academic, isn't it? Suffice it to say, the students in the foyer fled from the wildly approaching little vehicle. No doubt the melted snow and ice were on the beetle's tires, too, and marble, as everyone knows, is slippery. This way and that way, the dynamic little car hopped down the staircase. Great slabs of marble appeared to leap off the polished handrails of the stairway, the result of the Volkswagen's gouging out hunks of marble as it skidded from side to side. There's an old New Hampshire phrase that is meant to express extreme fragility and damage. Like a robin's egg rolling down the spout of a rain gutter. Thus did the headmaster descend the marble staircase from the great hall to the foyer of the main academy building. Except that he didn't quite arrive at his destination. The car flipped and landed on its roof and jammed itself sideways and upside down in the middle of the stairway. The doors could not be opened, nor could the headmaster be removed from the wreckage. Such spasms assailed his lower back that he could not contort himself into the necessary posture to make an exit from the car through the space where the windshield had been. Randy White, sitting upside down and holding fast to the steering wheel, cried out that there was a conspiracy of students and faculty who were clearly against him. He said numerous unprintable things about Dr. Dolder's fussy drinking habits, about all German manufactured cars, about what wimps were masquerading as able-bodied among the faculty and their wives, and he shouted and screamed that his back was killing him until his wife, Sam, could be brought to the scene, where she knelt on the chipped marble stairs and gave her upside-down husband what comfort she could. Professionals were summoned to extricate him from the destroyed Volkswagen. Later, long after morning meeting was over, they finally rescued the headmaster by removing the driver's side door of Dr. Dolder's poor car with a torch.
Thank you, David Bamber. David Hill, this is obviously a very comic scene, anarchic. There must be a schoolboy mischief streak in here that appeals to you.
Yes, actually.
We're lucky not to have a car up here, that's all.
It reminds me of something that happened at our school, at Cheetham's, where we had a very eccentric, and I'll come to him in a moment in some respects, but a teacher who really didn't, he didn't endear himself to any of us. And he'd had a lot of people may know this, a sunbeam rapier. And we thought we'd dress it up before he went off for his summer holidays. And so this reminded me of it. And I'm afraid when I first read this book, I roared with laughter. And if I had to put the book down, it's going to recover for a little while.
It's good to know the musical elites of the country do exactly what any other children and pupils would do.
Yeah, it was a good thing to do.
When you say you had a sort of mixed relationship with masters, I mean, that sort of pupil-teacher relationship, which I suppose one sort of imagines in music to be this giving and taking and perfectly seamless, I mean, how much of it was like that for you and how much is actually rather more difficult?
I think it was difficult because I think things have changed since I was at school. And teaching boys to sing in the last 30 years, I realised actually the way in which I was having to teach them was also changing, the relationship with them. And in a way, that you know, this 50s and 60s and even into the 70s, there was this kind of difficult relationship between you and them, really. I think there was almost an adversarial quality about the way they would approach things, and certainly about the way we looked at them as teachers. Whereas I think now, dare I say, on the whole, I think it's much more collaborative between the student and between the teacher. Maybe it's a bit less fun, I don't know. But it seems to be that, you know, that's how it used to be in my childhood. Mm-hmm. And we quite liked that. I think it gave it some, you know, real edge to what we were doing.
The book, as well as being very funny, and you reminded me of how good John Irving is at these mixed modes, and is this undertone of, has an undertone as well of faith and the role of death in life, inevitability, and rather big questions under the guise of a rollicking American novel.
Well, yes, indeed, and the whole book, as far as I was concerned, I was just reading it in the hope that I would get something from it, and my eldest daughter said to me, "This is a great book, Dad." I didn't realise it until I got some way into it did I feel the religious connotations and complexities. And you can see from the person who was writing it, his friend, that he viewed Owen Meany in a Christ-like way. Mm. You know, this extraordinary person who, on the whole, didn't lose his temper with people, just sort of, you know, could deal with most things, incredibly intelligent, articulate, just, you know, able to bring people along, very charismatic. Well, all those things. And, of course, eventually, and without spoiling the story for anyone, eventually a big price is paid by Owen Meany. And this sense of sacrifice equates to a lot of people to being the one that Jesus Christ made as on the cross. And so there is this development of the two ideas, I think, all of the time. I have to say, unashamedly, I like the more lugubrious music. I'm a Requiem man, love them, but, you know, not exclusively. But I do think that some of the finest music has been created from that sense in which we have to go inside ourselves and actually understand why we're here. And, you know, we're not immortal. You know, there is a moment when things will finish. And I think composers have actually, I mean, they've been unbelievably inspired by that and produced some of the finest music as a result, whether it's, for me, 1605 and Victoria's Requiem, or whether it's Berlioz and his thundering giant drums, or Verdi, terrifyingly so, in Adieu Irae, and so on. I think it's just produced some of the most extraordinary, violent, and exquisite music.
Well, I am afraid that that is where our time has run out. And so I would like to ask you to thank David Hill and David Bamber very much. And David Hill's Prom from the Angry Planet is on the 5th of August.
Anne McElvoy, who presented this evening's Proms Plus literary event. The producer was Allegra McIlroy. And a very warm welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall from me, Susie Klein, still to come tonight from the BBC Philharmonic and conductor laureate Gianandrea Nozeda, a performance of Mahler's most misunderstood symphony, the 7th. It has no programme, no extra musical idea driving it, there's no singer in this piece. This is the composer's most purely abstract work. But what it does have is the most extraordinary use of the orchestra, combining instruments and colours in a way that Mahler never had done before. For tonight's conductor, Gianandrea Nozeda, the 7th is a futuristic piece, pushing the boundaries of what an orchestra can do.
Mahler was very imaginative. He had a lot of visions. He tried to find new sounds. But he didn't have the live electronics. He didn't have the electronic music. If Mahler would have been living in the 50s, probably could have been one of the greatest Moderna, Nono, all these kind of Stockhausen, all these kind of men, very curious. He found the way to put, for instance, the cowbells in a symphony. He did already in the 6th symphony. He does again in the 7th. He put the mandolin and the guitar. I was wondering, why guitar and mandolin? Of course, it's an act music, but it's not written as a serenade, serenata. And serenata in Italy is something you go with a mandolin and a guitar just under the balcony where you try to seduce the lady. But this music doesn't sound this way. So it's a serenade, an act music for what? But he uses the same instruments. So that's why it's always a rebus, an enigma, a mystery. And you have to go through imagining what he's aiming from. I don't know. Probably from the beginning, which is a sort of trauer march, to arrive to this joyful finale, which doesn't sound completely joyful to me. It's like if I don't feel, I feel a little bit depressed, but I don't want to show it. So when I meet other people, I try to overact, just to show over-exaggerated, over-the-top happiness. I think the finale sounds a little bit like that. So it's more Mahler in the beginning of the symphony and the first Nachtmusik, especially in the scherzo, which is just the center point of all the symphonies.
Gianandrea Nozeda here to conduct the players of the BBC Philharmonic in Mahler's Seventh Symphony.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
the close of Mahler's Seventh Symphony. The performance here at the BBC Proms, given tonight by the BBC Philharmonic and its conductor laureate, Gianandrea Nozeda. He told me earlier, this is such a dark piece, so difficult to conduct. Sometimes the depths you have to plumb with this symphony make it such an emotionally bumpy ride. He says he won't conduct Mahler's Third more than once every 3 or 4 years because you have to look after your heart and it might be dangerous to perform it more often than that. The leader of the BBC Philharmonic, Yuri Torchinsky, on his feet now, applauding fellow members of this orchestra. Such a great atmosphere here today. Fantastic for them to be reunited with a conductor whom they've worked with for so many years, almost a decade. Gianandrea Nozeda was at the helm of the BBC Philharmonic in this, the second of 4 proms they're giving at this season, 2012 proms. Maestro himself returning to the stage now to congratulate his players. Fantastic warmth between all of them. And that performance of Mahler's Seventh Symphony concluding tonight's concert. Don't forget that, as always, you can hear it again via the BBC iPlayer and every concert of the Proms broadcast live right here on Radio 3. We will be back again tomorrow, but for now, it's time to hand you back to Broadcasting House and Ian Skelly.
Susie, thank you very much indeed. Susie Klein at the Royal Albert Hall for us tonight. And as she said, you can hear it again, that concert, on the Radio 3 website. If you prefer, you can hear it again on the radio when the recording will be broadcast a week today at 2 o'clock during Afternoon on 3. Well, yes, tomorrow night we're going to be paying not one but 2 visits to the Royal Albert Hall. First of all at 7 o'clock to hear a colourful all-English programme given by the combined forces of the BBC Symphony Chorus, the BBC National Chorus and Orchestra of Wales, all conducted by another stalwart of a BBC band, Tadaaki Otakar. The Fantasia on a theme by Thomas Tallis is the opening number in that concert. We've also got music by John Ireland, The Walk to the Paradise Garden by Delius, and to end, Walton's Belshazzar's Feast, which should certainly raise the roof tomorrow night in the hall. Then we have a late prom tomorrow evening. That's given by the Radio 3 World Roots Academy protégé, the accordion player José Hernando Arias Nogueira. He's going to be playing a programme of Vallenato music from Colombia, new songs and old ones, with a whole host of Colombian musicians in support. That late prom begins here on Radio 3, live from the Royal Albert Hall at 10:15 tomorrow night. Full details on the Radio 3 website. Well, a very good evening to you from me, Ian Skelly. Our next programme tonight is the next in our summer series of Lebrecht interviews. And tonight, Norman Lebrecht will be talking to the Hungarian conductor, Ivan Fischer, who will reflect on his many groundbreaking musical achievements and the more than his fair share of political controversy. You can hear what that was and what caused it too tonight at 10 o'clock. Then we'll trace the history of money this evening. We're going to head back 11,000 years to when cattle were first domesticated and very quickly became units of exchange. Cows and Shells, the title of our essay series tonight and this week at 10:45. And that's followed by an exciting new jazz collaboration between the Scandinavian free jazz trio, The Thing, and the vocalist Naina Cherry. Jez Nelson will be here to explain in Jazz on 3, which begins tonight at 11 o'clock. But it's a little after 9:45 now, and next tonight, music from France. Piano music by Saint-Saëns, a piece composed actually as a test piece for a competition in 1894. Music dedicated to the brother-in-law of his piano duet partner, the composer Thomas Ambroise. It's played here by Piers Lane. Music by Saint-Saëns, a theme and variations in effect, is Opus 97, played there by Piers Lane. Well, with an eye on tomorrow night's first of two proms from the Royal Albert Hall, an all-English programme, particularly the Vaughan Williams tomorrow night, the Fantasia on a theme of Thomas Tallis, which opens the concert, I thought I'd take you to 10 o'clock and our next programme this evening, the Lebrecht interview with Ivan Fischer, with some English music for the clarinet. This is by Lloyd Webber, William Lloyd Webber, who studied under Vaughan Williams at the Royal College of Music in London and dedicated this air and variations to one of his colleagues when he returned there as Professor of Composition. It's played here by the clarinetist John Bradbury and the pianist James Cryer.
Thank you.
an air and variations by William Lloyd Webber, dedicated to Frederick Thurston and his pupils at the Royal College of Music. It was played there by the clarinetist John Bradbury and the pianist James Cryer. And plenty more English music, as I say, tomorrow night on Radio 3 in the first of our two proms given by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, conducted by Tadaaki Ottokar. Vaughan Williams to begin, John Ireland, Delius and Walton's Belshazzar's Feast. All live from the Royal Albert Hall here on BBC Radio 3 from the earlier time of 7 o'clock tomorrow night. Well, in 45 minutes, how cows and shells began the process that became a universal form of exchange. The history of money explored in our essays this week at 11:15. But first, with the time at just after 10, here's Norman Lebrecht with the Lebrecht interview.
Ivan Fischer stands in the line of Hungarians who invented and developed the conducting profession. Hans Richter and Arthur Nikisch were co-founders. Anton Seidel, Eugene Ormandy, Antal Dorati, George Self, Fritz Reiner, the American pioneers, Ferenc Fritschoy in Berlin, István Kertész and George Scholte led the next generation. No small nation has made so huge an impact on any performing art. Ivan and his brother Adam Fischer grew up under communism and made their names on both sides of the Iron Curtain. Now, both have fallen out with their country, taking a principled stand against a right-wing government and rising racialism. Born into a musical family in 1951, Ivan enjoyed an elite communist education. He then studied in Vienna with Hans Swarovski and Nicolaus Harnoncourt. He got started in Britain as music director of Kent Opera and the Northern Sinfonia in the 1970s. He's also been music director at Lyon in France and is about to enter a new job with the Concerthaus Orchestra in Berlin. His chief involvement, though, is with the Budapest Festival Orchestra that he founded with Zoltán Kocsis 30 years ago and with which he has made dozens of recordings. He's fallen out badly with Kocsis over national politics and now divides his time between Budapest and Amsterdam, where we meet in his living room. Ivan Fischer, living in more than one country is a Hungarian tradition. It goes back to Franz Liszt and his Vie trifurcée, a life divided three ways. Why is it that so many Hungarian artists feel such a need to be rooted somewhere else?
It's a dividing line. There are the Hungarians who stayed and the Hungarians who left. And it seems to me that there is a clear line between the cosmopolitan Hungarians and the nationalist Hungarians. It's always been like that. We remember when Gustav Mahler used to be the opera director in Budapest, he got into very, very heavy conflict with the then nationalist Hungarian camp. And these are names people know less in the Western world, like the Erkel family. Mm. We know Ferenc Erkel, who wrote the big nationalist Hungarian operas, but his son, Sándor Erkel, was a conductor who had a very important reputation in Hungary, but nobody knew him outside of Hungary.
It's a double insecurity, isn't it? That the fear of being an outsider in a nationalist society, so you have to live somewhere else, or the fear of staying and then being regarded as provincial and mediocre.
I don't know if it's fear. One should look at examples. Béla Bartók stayed there and had very strong feelings for being Hungarian. Mm. Although he immediately recognized that being a nationalist is something he wanted to distance himself very, very clearly. For example, when he started to collect next to Hungarian also Romanian and Slovak folk songs and extended his work into the neighboring countries. Mm. He was seen as a traitor in Hungary, Bartók, at that time in the 30s. And then he got to the point where he said, now I have to leave, because when the Horthy regime became more and more friendly with the Nazis, he reached the point, this is the time to leave. And I think in his case, it wasn't really fear. He wasn't Jewish, he wasn't threatened physically, he had very strong moral standards. And on the other hand, for example, somebody like Zoltán Kodály, his friend stayed. Kod, I had much more to fear because he did have a Jewish wife.
Yes.
So it's interesting. It comes down to personalities.
And there was this three-way split, wasn't there, between the composers at that time. Bartók left on principle. Kodály stayed and kept very quiet. And Ernő Dohnányi collaborated.
Yes, this collaboration is a disputed story. Because
it always is.
Then
it's natural. And now.
Yes. I couldn't agree more. I mean, in the case of Furtwängler or all of them, in case of Dohnányi, there is one photo which really damaged his reputation, where he appears together with the Szálasi, the Nazi leader of a Hungarian Nazi party. And he stayed in position, like Furtwängler did and many others. I wouldn't go as far as seeing him as a collaborator, but he didn't distance himself, that's true.
You were born into a family that you described as musical, intellectual, Hungarian, and Jewish. In which order did these qualities strike you as a child?
Well, it's a very, very mixed, blurred picture, because it wasn't a religious Jewish family, very much like most of the East or Central European musical families. Maybe the grandfather was an observant Jew, but my father, for example, wasn't anymore. So somewhere somebody made the step to step out of religion, but because of having this desire or being used to adore something or believe in something, they somehow passed their idols from divine things to cultural things. So also in our family, you know, Goethe, Beethoven, Mozart were looked upon as gods in a way. And maybe we didn't discuss the Talmud, but we discussed everything around culture.
You grew up opposite the opera house where Mahler conducted, just across the road from where you live.
Yes.
So it's almost an extension of your living room.
Well, in Boris Godunov, for example, where we sang in the children's choir a few years later, the children sing in the first coronation scene, and then again when they take the money from the fool near the end of the opera. And between the two scenes, we had time to go home for dinner. And the great fun was that we could go home for dinner in costumes and have our dinner and go back to the second scene and take the money from the fool.
And then 1970, 71, you went to Vienna. Did you go together with Adam?
No, Adam went first.
Adam went
and
first.
I joined him a year later.
And he went to study with Swarovski.
Swarovski.
But you weren't going to be a conductor, you were a cellist.
No, cellist, that's right.
So how did you get into Swarovski's class?
Well, he always wanted to be a conductor.
Adam.
So he knew from his rather early childhood that this was like his ambition. And I was a very different character. It's difficult to describe this, but he was more the obedient child who, in a way, realized what our father's image was. And I was very different. I was more the difficult child who argued and discussed things, and I didn't agree with many things, and I was looking for other areas. I was very much interested in theater, especially avant-garde theater at the time. And then I went to Vienna as a cellist. I knew that I wasn't really somebody who concentrates on playing the instrument. I was searching for something else. And then I went to visit the classroom of my brother, and Swarovski was the most important personality in that music academy. There were other things too, but Swarovski's class was the magnetic classroom where everybody wanted to be in. So I thought, maybe I should try that too. But in the same time, I also studied with Nicolas Harnoncourt, who he taught wonderfully. It was just about the meaning of music, and I loved it. It was a course for early music for anybody, singers, instrumentalists, conductors.
And what were the different things you got from Swarovski and Harnoncourt? Swarovski was Hungarian. He was a very celebrated conducting teacher. He taught Abado, he taught Zubmeta, many others, Sinopoli. He was a specialist conducting teacher, and Harnoncourt was a self-made philosopher of early music.
I think both were. Swarovski had very strong mind and fantastic ideas, and Harnoncourt too, completely the opposite. Swarovski was somebody of the neue Sachlichkeit. This is everything rational, everything factual. He said, this is not about some mystery, it's about a G flat and a F sharp, and that's it. And only the structure matters in music. This is Swarovski. Harnoncourt, on the other side, read between the lines. The score is only a shorthand. There are messages there which you have to discover. It's about feelings. It's about communication. It's about rhetoric, all kinds of things. It was the opposite.
And then you went to London. You won a competition. And the rest of the 70s is Northern Sinfonia.
That was a few years later.
Yeah, a little later. And Kent Opera. Tell me about Kent Opera. Because you must have realized when you started working there that it was always about 5 minutes from being closed down. It was a pioneering company which had also done early music and had done new works by Tippett, but existed financially on a shoestring.
I will tell you about Kent Opera, which is a beautiful story. But before that, I would like to just briefly describe between the competition in 1967 and joining Kent Opera in 82, those 6 years I spent going from one orchestra to the next. I had many invitations as guest conductors, and I also worked with the Northern Sinfonia for a few years. But I had fantastic offers. I had a world tour with the London Symphony Orchestra, and I didn't like it. And I remember sitting in a hotel room and making notes about this is all wrong and this is not how an orchestra should function. And there is a major problem about the symphony orchestra as a phenomenon, and nobody thinks about the future of orchestras, and nobody solves the problems. And I developed a whole reform idea in my mind, in many, many notes, how an orchestra should actually work. And in 82, I came to the point that I said, I stop with this profession completely because I didn't like conducting these orchestras. And at that time, two things happened to me. One was that I met Kent Opera. Kent Opera invited me. And suddenly there was this fantastic idealism, a young opera company with a young orchestra and a fantastic mentality, which I will describe. And in the same time, I went back to Hungary, and a lot of musicians came to me and said, why don't we do something? And I had the feeling that this is where I can put my reform ideas into practice and start an entirely new orchestra.
Describe Kent Opera. It must have been the least Hungarian place to go in the world.
Yes, but the idea, the idealism was enormous. Norman Platt was the founder of Kent Opera. Norman had strong ideas. First of all, he wanted to take operas to the regions. He wanted to make cheap opera for people who simply loved the operas. It had to be in the language of the listeners. Singers had to make sure that the listeners understand the words and follow the story. No subtitles, no original language. It had to be productions which are simple, minimal, and are completely in harmony with the meaning of the opera and the music. And in the balance of visual and acoustic experience, music had to come first. And I came in a time when there was a break between Norman Platt and Roger Norrington. Roger Norrington just went through these metamorphoses that he got fascinated by period instruments and early music, which he didn't do before this 82 year and wanted to change the Kent Opera into a kind of authentic
period company.
And Norman Platt didn't like it because his main priority was communication to the audiences and not to satisfy any scientific or other things. And they clashed about this principle. There was nothing else, but this was an important issue. Roger left and Norman Platt called me, and it was a great few years I spent with this company.
And were you there at the end? Were you there when it was shut down?
Yes, of course. I was at 105 Piccadilly discussing...
At the Arts Council?
Yes, discussing the cutting of Kent Opera with the...
Can you describe that?
Well,
you kill an opera company?
Well, this particular killing was very unusual because the Duke of Kent, in a way, not completely in harmony with protocol, decided to stand up for Kent Opera and came with us to the Arts Council. So we were sitting around the table and there were these Arts Council officials on one side and the Duke of Kent and me and a few others on the other side of the table. And can you imagine this amazing situation? And he very generously said that, I hope you can do something to save this wonderful company. And those gentlemen explained us why they don't. And it was all about saving this very, very small subsidy Kent Opera received and probably transferring to others. This issue can be read about in Norman Platt's book about Kent Opera, which I highly urge everybody to read. But I think it still hasn't been completely unveiled what were the real reasons why the Arts Council decided to make this very drastic move and how interconnected the Arts Council's officials were with other regional opera companies. This is a very, very difficult issue, which I don't know any details. Norman was very daring in his book, but I think it should be once looked at very carefully.
You had a suspicion of corruption?
I don't think it was corruption. I wouldn't like to accuse anybody of anything like that. But interests. I mean, of course, everybody was fighting for more subsidy and all the other regional companies. And there were a few of them who also were in various advising panels of the Arts Council. But I don't know anything more than that.
Tell me about your principles in founding the Budapest Festival Orchestra. It was just so different from anything else that existed in Budapest, a command economy, and you were founding a private orchestra. What were the principles behind it?
One major goal was to create an orchestra where jadedness has no chance, where the apathy or the kind of passive nature cannot enter. And in order to do that, I did various studies how to encourage the creativity of the individual. So let's imagine you would join an orchestra, you win an audition, you sit down at the fifth desk of a violin session. From that moment, you are required to follow the conductor, to follow the concertmaster, not stick out, but go with the group. And I thought, how do we promote somebody like this? Where is room for individuality? Where is room for your creativity if you have something to offer? And if there is none, naturally, you become, after a while, a little tired and you lose your motivation. You may lose your love for the music. So I wanted to form an orchestra where the individual has a chance to stay creative and fulfill various ambitions. And in order to do that, I had to introduce many practical differences to the usual orchestral setup.
Such as?
Well, for example, one thing is how much does an orchestra play? I had a certain feeling that to play as much as symphony orchestras nowadays do is a little too much, because it's tiring for the musician. So we limited the orchestral work to 30 weeks in a year. And then the rest of the time is filled with various things where the individual creativity can have channels of possibilities.
Teaching, communication, how?
It's more like a conversation with the person. Just try to imagine you are one of the musicians. I would sit down with you and say, what interests you? Do you have any special territory? For example, one of our violinists said that he made a serious research in early 19th century Hungarian music, what was played in Hungarian sort of aristocratic mansions. Said, wonderful. Then why don't you make a cycle of those concerts? You can visit the mansions and do mansion concerts. You program it, you choose your partners, and put a little chamber orchestra together and play Bihari and Rózsa Völgyi and this great repertoire. There's another person said he's really into contemporary music, and now he formed an ensemble and he has his dates and he looks after those concerts.
There must have been a lot of opposition from government, society, other musicians, other orchestras.
There was jealousy, you're right. And also a little bit about some of the ideas we had, because we don't offer job security, we don't have a union. It's completely freelance orchestra, and it's in the founding document. There was a democratic vote of the first generation, of the first musicians, and they democratically decided that there should be no job security and no trade union in this orchestra. Only music should matter.
Who owns the orchestra?
It's a foundation. That is a board of directors who appoint me.
Your co-founder, the Budapest Festival Orchestra, was Zoltán Kocsis, brilliant pianist who was becoming a conductor. You were jointly in charge at the beginning, and the beginning was very happy.
Very, very is maybe a strong word. Okay. was let's say, reasonably happy. We always had differences from the first day. And I think the differences he and I had were about how to work with people and how to treat people. He's, I think, a genius musician, wonderful pianist. And he also started to conduct, and I absolutely encouraged that. I was the first one who said, do it, you're doing it very well. Of course, one needs to learn and one needs certain experience, but he offered something which most conductors don't offer, a very high level of musicianship. The difference was how to treat the orchestra. He is somebody who dictates from above, and I wanted to work through the creativity of the musicians, encouraging them, giving opportunities, making sure, taking away the fear factor, for example. And he was much more dictatorial, who kind of pushed this general good feeling down, and that was the reason for the clash.
Did you have to ask him to leave?
Well, we had big, big problems at the end because I didn't agree with some things he did. And then at a certain point, I told him, look, Zoli, there is no point. We pull this orchestra in two directions. If you want to do it, I will leave. Fine. He said, no, no, no. I mean, from the start, you were the leader of this orchestra. He was there, but he was never really leading it.
The last time we spoke, Zoltán Kocsis was music director of the Hungarian National Philharmonic, and you were accusing him of collaborating with right-wing elements in the government. Do you still believe that he sold out to the forces?
Well, I never accused him of that. I don't think I ever did. I would, I don't remember having said that, but I also don't think it's true. I think he made one particular unfortunate interview in the Süddeutsche Zeitung where he just avoided to be critical at a time where I think everybody should be critical. And of course, it all comes down to subsidy, which orchestra is subsidized and to what degree. And the Hungarian National Philharmonic received very generous subsidies of the state, and we were always seen as a little independent, opinionated, critical lot. So he is like the protocol orchestra's music director, having good relations with whatever government comes into Hungary, and avoiding to be critical. I think that's all, but not really more than that.
You were supposed to be working together on a joint Bartók edition, a recorded edition.
Yes. There was this Bartók, the new Bartók edition of Hungaroton. This is what you're referring to. Mm-hmm. Hungaroton, a state-owned company, was privatized in the early 90s. And then they became like a shoestring company after that. They announced, I don't remember how many years ago, like 6, 7, 8 years ago, that they want to make a new Bartók recorded edition, mainly with Zoltán Kocsis as the, I don't know, musical leader who would record most of the recordings, but it's under his leadership. Everybody welcomed it, and I also welcomed this idea, nothing wrong with it. But then they asked for state subsidy, and they received this state subsidy with the arguments, and I had only problems about the arguments, which said that it's absolutely necessary that Bartók is being presented in its authentic national Hungarian form as it should be, and in our generation leaves a document of Bartók with its real Hungarian authenticity. And many of the musicians, including me, protested against this because we said, what about Solti? What about other pianists like Dezső Ránki? What about me with the Budapest Festival Orchestra? Aren't we Hungarian? We have been doing Bartók recordings all these years without any state subsidy and without anybody saying this is the real thing. How can you say that this is all non-Hungarian and now we need the real Hungarian authentic Bartók being performed, and that is the justification for the edition and for the state subsidizing this edition? So we thought this argumentation is not correct, and that led to a little public debate.
Ivan, what's gone wrong with Hungary in the democratic era? A boom economy has gone bust, and a right-wing government is now fostering ultra-nationalists. A neo-Nazi playwright has been put in charge of a Budapest theater. The Speaker of Parliament celebrates a poet who praised Hitler. The Prime Minister, Viktor Orban, sits in Parliament while one of his MPs repleats the blood libel against the Jews. The pianist András Schiff has said he will never play there again. Your brother Adam called on the European Parliament to isolate Hungary. Where do you stand?
I completely agree with András, with my brother and all the critical voices.
So we have to put Hungary in the freezer.
Well, the question is, where will Hungary put itself? And this is the main question. I think the present nationalist wave in Hungary is playing with fire. It's hugely dangerous, because what is the alternative? Hungary has to choose between being a European country. It needs to do some catching up. I mean, from the economy point of view, learning, after the isolation behind the Iron Curtain, it's not easy to compete. And If you grow tomatoes, you have to compete with the French farmer who sells it cheaper. So Europe is not an easy experience for Hungarians. It needs a little hard work. But one alternative is joining Europe. And what is the alternative? If you shut yourself up, my main problem is that a small country like Hungary has no chance, no natural resources. What can it do alone? It's a completely unrealistic dream to be nationalist and anti-European. And Hungary, if it continues into this playing of fire, it will become an easy prey of any dangerous world power who will say, do you need some money? I give you some money. I just want something in return. Exactly as Hitler did to Hungary in the 30s. Now, I'm not saying which dangerous power this will be, but easy prey, Hungary, at the moment. So I think it's very, very dangerous what they are doing, and there is one solution, U-turn, join the European club again.
András Schiff has declared a personal boycott. Should other artists do the same?
I don't think this should be prescribed. You see, there are people there. I always feel that I make music for the people, wonderful people in Hungary who need music. And I think I'm consequent enough if I stay there, but I'm very critical about the present nationalist developments in Hungary. And I don't compromise on speaking freely about that.
It's a delicate line.
Well, it's delicate because of course, I'm dependent. They may take away my orchestra's grants and then we may end up with no subsidy. But it's a very, very real danger. But I don't think it's a strong enough argument to keep my mouth shut.
Let's talk briefly about America. You were in the running several times to be a music director, all the way back to Baltimore in the 1990s. But it never happened. You were principal conductor or next in line, always the bride's sister, but never the bride. What went wrong in America?
I never wanted to.
You never wanted to be music director?
No.
You were offered it in Washington couple of years ago. And
this I cannot say yes or no because it's a confidential issue. So I cannot really answer that. What precisely happened? It was discussed as a possibility.
Right, but it didn't happen.
It didn't happen.
You never wanted to be music director in America. Why?
Because I don't believe in the system.
Which bits?
Well, many, many, many. But I think it's a long story, I think there was the generation of the great tyrannical conductors, the Fritz Reiners, George Sell, and all the others. I'm just very brief now. As a counter reaction to that, the orchestras became strong. The trade unions defended the musicians against Fritz Reiner, basically. I agree with them. I agree with this development because I completely disagree with the method how Fritz Reiner treated the musicians. But I think that the rules which this new system created are so rigid and so stubborn that they don't allow an orchestra to develop. So with one word, after the tyranny of Fritz Reiner came the tyranny of the trade unions. And I believe in a third system. I don't want to go back to the Fritz Reiner period. I believe in rethinking, reshaping, talking to each other, finding new ways, because I'm very concerned about the future of the symphony orchestras. What the American orchestras are doing is they have a Bible called the CBA. This is the collective bargaining agreement. It's a thick book, and they are following this Bible, and the job is to follow that, and I think it doesn't give room to creativity. With other words, George Sell had the chance to go to Cleveland and create a fantastic orchestra in a provincial small town. George Sell today couldn't do that because of the CBA. He wouldn't have the room. And it has nothing to do with tyranny and being tyrannical. And it's not about throwing people out. It's not about that. It's about having the flexibility of developing quality. And today, what you see is there is no chance for a second or third-rate American orchestra to go up to the top level because the rigid system. At the moment, quality is looked after by the players themselves. I've seen it many times. The Berlin Philharmonic, Cleveland Orchestra, whichever continent, the players pass on the musical tradition to each other, and they select each other, they tell each other how to play. It's not the music director anymore. And therefore, the Berlin Philharmonic and Cleveland will stay on a high level. And if a board asks a new conductor, bring our orchestra up from here to here, no chance. They should look at their system and reform it. If they don't, they will die out like dinosaurs.
Your new job in Berlin is with the orchestra that time forgot, the former Berlin Symphony Orchestra that was set up as a cross-wall counter to the Berlin Philharmonic and has faded since 1989. What do you hope to do there?
Well, it's interesting. I hear this question very much, and before I stopped working with agencies, I remember it came up from agents, especially like, oh, wow, is this a good career move? And of course, it's a horrible career move. I always laughed about it because, I mean, that's really, it doesn't concern me at all. There was something which pulled me there. And it has to do with the audiences. When I got first this invitation, and there were many orchestras approaching me, first of all, it was the musicians themselves who came to me, no manager, no agency, and that was already sympathetic. And the second thing which really made me decide was the audience problem or question. I went to hear many concerts there and talked to people and realized that the Berlin Wall is down now for more than 20 years. And there is a large number, thousands of Berlin music lovers who go to the Concerthaus and never walk over to the Philharmonie. There's a fantastically loyal East Berlin public in large number of subscribers who come to this Concerthaus orchestra. I was fascinated by this. Why don't they go? I mean, the tickets are not much more expensive. It's 500 meters to the Philharmonie. You could walk there. They don't go.
They still think the wall... They act as if the
For
wall
them,
is still
For them, the wall is there. And then I talked to people and I realized that there is a special emotional contact. These people, and it's not only the elderly, they somehow pass it on to their children. They lived under this East German dictatorship. Very gloomy, very difficult, very hopeless, locked up. I mean, we know what it was like. For them, music was like a ray of happiness and positive devotion they could feel. And it was connected with this building, this wonderful Gendarmenmarkt, beautiful part of Berlin, beautiful building, restored by the East Germans in the 80s. It looks great, sounds great. And people go to this place like an oasis of happiness where they went to in this East German gloominess. And they still feel that, and they still feel like, of course we stay loyal to this place because this is where we belong. These were the best moments of our lives. And it's passed on to the young as well. And they form a type of public in the concert house which creates an incredible emotional contact between performers and listeners, far, far more exciting than the few roads over where the West Berlin Orchestra plays to the very normal, very nice, but let's say normal concert audiences. And it also affects the orchestra. The orchestra also feels that there is this symbiosis with the public, and there is a fantastic mentality. They really would like to just do it well, make music. I've never met an orchestra with a more positive radiation than there.
Ivan, you're 61, and half of your life has been devoted to changing the orchestra, to the Budapest Festival Orchestra, and to changing the idea of an orchestra. Do you think these ideas are now taking root? Is the orchestra still something that you would look at as you did 30 years ago and think, I could give this up?
Completely, yes. When I go to other orchestras, I immediately get a shock of, my God, these people have no idea that it can be done differently. Most orchestras, unfortunately, still work in their rigid, habitual way, and it became so indoctrined in a way that it became an art form which is extremely difficult to change. And I'm very worried because there are clear threats to the phenomenon symphony orchestra. One threat I would like to mention is the volume. There are many improvements of instruments, parts of instruments, a new mouthpiece for a trumpet, a new kind of string for a violin. All these little improvements add up and they all increase the sound. The level is now so loud that it's extremely damaging for the ear. And of course, it's bad for the health. And that has been described many times. But I want to add another argument, that it takes away the pleasure. If you are a viola player sitting in front of the trumpetist all your life, don't tell me that you can enjoy, you know, a loud symphony. And this problem of the volume has to be addressed, because if it doesn't, it may kill the symphony orchestra.
And the role of the conductor in the second half of the 21st century?
I think the conductor, hopefully, should be not the... What we have today is this kind of... I don't know if I will insult people, but who cares? Like this mixture of beauty contest and politician. You know, this is the present-day conductor who wants to be popular and attractive, but doesn't do anything, basically. Doesn't change things, doesn't even think about how to change, but just goes, swims with the... floats with the waves. I think the real conductor was really the pre-war generation, the respected musician in a community who had absolutely unquestionable respect and who cared about the music life, and the audiences also. So I think the future conductor should be a caring person who makes sure that there is culture, and culture is provided to the audiences and leads the musicians who have natural respect for him or her. I think that should be the future.
Ivan Fischer, Kurzhanam Sefin, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ivan Fischer was talking to Norman Lebrecht, and the producer was Georgia Mann-Smith. Well, that programme is available to listen to again on the Radio 3 website. You can also download it from there as a podcast. Well, Norman's back next Monday, and he'll be talking to the celebrated impresario Lillian Hochhauser, who, along with her husband Victor, introduced British audiences to some of the greatest Russian musicians of all time during the period of Soviet rule. That's at the same time next Monday at 9:30 here on BBC Radio 3. Well, now, the essay, and a chance this week to hear three perspectives on the origins of money. In the first essay, Keith Hart, Emeritus Professor of Anthropology at the University of London, takes us to the beginning of ideas about monetary exchange when currency came in all shapes and sizes.
As soon as I was old enough, I was given threepence a week pocket money. I was a regular customer at Mrs. Hewitt's sweet shop. She reserved my favourites for me and sometimes gave me extra measure. When she sold the shop, she introduced her regulars to the new owner. "This is Keith," she would say, "and he likes wine gums, pear drops and licorice all sorts." It was a time of rationing following the Second World War. So in addition to my threepence, which bought 2 ounces of sweets, I handed over a coupon entitling the bearer to that quantity. One day, when I was 5, my mother announced that sugar rationing was over. From now on, people could buy as many sweets as they liked. I rushed to Mrs. Hewitt's and ordered sweets up to the limit of my imagination. 3 bags of 2 ounces each. "That will be 9 pence, please," she said. "But I only have 3 pence. They said you could now have as much as you like." Well, you need the money too. And that's how I learnt the bitter lesson that money, or at least the stuff I grew up with, is also a rationing device. Markets are democratically open to anybody. All you need is the money. Since then, I've been obsessed with getting to know what money really is and how to get round its restrictions. I became an anthropologist in part to explore alternatives to the money system. But why would we be interested in the origins of money today? Because it's changing dramatically before our eyes. If money is the ground on which we stand, the financial shocks of the last 3 years have vividly brought home how shaky that foundation is. The physical substance of money is giving way to bits whizzing around cyberspace. Personal credit is now available on terms that were unimaginable a few years ago. And we read about vast sums of money being created and disappearing overnight. So what is happening to money? Where did it come from? And where is it going? But of course, we all know where money came from. Our remote ancestors started swapping things they had too much of and others wanted. But it wasn't always easy to find someone who wanted what you had and had what you wanted. For many natural products, the timing of supply and demand doesn't coincide. So some objects became valued as tokens to hold for use in future exchanges. It might be salt or ox hides, but especially precious metals. Gold, silver, and copper were scarce, attractive, useful, durable, portable, and divisible. Barter's limitations were lifted as soon as sellers would accept these money tokens, knowing that they could use them later. All this is a myth, of course, but what does it tell us? It tells us that money is a real thing and a scarce commodity, that it is more efficient and its origin was in barter. When Adam Smith first told this story, he claimed that the wealth of nations resulted from the slow working out of a deep-seated propensity in human nature.
To truck, barter, and exchange one thing for another.
He went on,
"It is common to all men, and to be found in no other race of animals, which seem to know neither this nor any other species of contracts. Nobody ever saw a dog make a fair and deliberate exchange of one bone for another with another dog. Nobody ever saw one animal by its gestures and natural cries signify to another, 'This is mine, that yours. I am willing to give this for that.'"
At least Smith acknowledged the degree of social complexity in these transactions, the idea of contract, private property, mine and yours, and equivalence or fairness. none of which could plausibly be traced to the non-human world. His latter-day successors, however, have not shown similar modesty, routinely claiming that behavior in Wall Street is driven by impulses that are not just eternally human, but shared with the animals too, or at least the primates. Listen to Nicholas Dunbar in his book Inventing Money.
In chimpanzee communities, individuals exchange gifts, such as fruit or sexual favors, within a group to cement alliances and punish those who attempt to cheat on such mutually beneficial relationships. Anthropologists believe that early humans started trading in much the same way. The word they use to describe this behavior is reciprocity, and our personal relationships work on this basis.
That's quite a lot of metaphysics piled onto the observation that chimps sometimes pleasure each other and pass on the odd bit of fruit. But two claims are being made here, that private property is natural, therefore inevitable, and as it underpins most other important things in our lives. Adam Smith seems almost cautious in comparison. The first time I arrived in the market square of a West African village, I saw four beefy men dragging a young woman by the hair, kicking and screaming. "It's all right," said my companion. "They're just her brothers." She was married to an old man with many wives, a major political figure. She had run away several times with her lover. The old man demanded his bride wealth back, the standard payment of four cows to his wife's lineage. But her brothers had already spent the cows on a marriage, and they didn't want to break their alliance with him. So this was a public affirmation of their commitment to the marriage. Modern capitalist economies base the accumulation of wealth on production of inanimate things for sale, but traditional African economies had as their object the production of human life. So cattle were used to secure the reproduction of kin groups through marriage. When Europeans first saw women being exchanged for cows, they thought they were being bought. In fact, bride wealth consists of animal tokens whose payment secures the marriage and allows the recipients to find another woman to replace the one they have lost. They're rationing coupons more than money. In these societies, animals were traditionally the main means of saving and accumulation. The word for interest in some languages is water, on the analogy of a loan of cattle. If a cow has offspring while on loan, the borrower, when returning its mother, kept the calf as a reward for having watered them. Note that the interest was paid to the borrower who did the work. Cattle are thus a source of increase, a store of wealth, and a means of payment in marriage and for other large debts. They are not a standard of value or a medium of exchange, since very little can be measured by them or exchanged for them. Most people are reluctant to sell them just for cash, much as we would prefer to replace a car with another one rather than sell it to pay our debts. In recent decades, the fastest growing sector of world trade has been in services, such as entertainment, education, media, software, and information. This trend makes the economy more about what people do for each other, that is, services, than the physical objects that make up their material livelihood. After early industrialization, the predominant focus of the world economy is reverting to the development of human beings. We have a lot to learn from the human economies of Africa, where people always had priority over things, and where cows still have some, if not all, of the properties of modern money. As an anthropologist, I've been inspired by a famous exchange after the First World War between the founders of modern anthropology in Britain and France concerning whether shell valuables circulating in Melanesia were money or not. Bronislaw Malinowski published Argonauts of the Western Pacific in 1922, when the year's hit movie was Nanook of the North, a tale of Eskimo resilience in the face of a harsh environment. After the slaughter of the trenches, the old imperialist story about our mission to civilize them lay in tatters. So when Malinowski produced his account of native adventurers, heirs to the tradition of noble heroes, his story found a receptive audience. The coolering of the Trobriand Islanders and their neighbors provided an allegory of the world economy. Here was a civilization spread across many small islands, each incapable of providing a decent livelihood by itself, that relied on international trade mediated by the exchange of precious ornaments. There were no states, money, or capitalists, and instead of buying cheap and selling dear, the trade was sustained by an ethic of generosity. Homo economicus was not only absent, but upstaged by comparison, revealed as a shabby and narrow-minded successor to a world the West had lost. Malinowski was adamant that cooler valuables were not money, in that they didn't function as a medium of exchange and standard of value. But his French contemporary, Marcel Mauss, in his celebrated essay The Gift, held out for a broader approach.
On this reasoning, there has only been money when precious things have been really made into currency, namely have been inscribed and impersonalized, and detached from any relationship with any legal entity, whether collective or individual, other than the state that mints them. One only defines in this way a second type of money, our own.
Most believe that the limits of society must be extended to become ever more inclusive. Society has to be made and remade, sometimes from scratch. On a diplomatic mission or a first date, we give presents. The cooler valuables enable inter-island exchange by forming partnerships between the persons who guarantee the peace for the trade. For most, this made them a kind of money. Heroic gift exchange is designed to push the limits of society outwards. No society is ever economically self-sufficient. In addition to setting social limits at the local level, a community must also extend its reach abroad. This is why money in some form and the markets it makes possible are universal, according to Mauss. Now, money is often portrayed as a lifeless object separated from persons, whereas in fact it is a creation of human beings imbued with the collective spirit of the living and the dead. As a token of society, it must be impersonal in order to connect individuals to the universe of relations to which they belong. But people make everything personal too, including their relations with society. This two-sided relationship is universal, but highly variable. The cooler canoe expeditions were dangerous and magical because their crews were temporarily outside the realm of normal society. Neoliberal globalization and the digital revolution in communications have led to a rapid expansion of money and markets in recent decades. Society has been extended beyond its national limits, becoming more unequal and more unstable in the process. Reliance on the pound sterling and the barter myth of money's origins will not help us to find solutions. We need to rethink what money is for and what we might do with it. Other traditions, such as those of Africa and the Pacific, may show us how to make any future economy more human.
Professor Keith Hart presenting the first of this week's essays on the origins of money. The readers' readings...